Chapter 63. Victor Kelson and his attorney arrived at Jenkins and Fairchild's office promptly at 2 p.m. and took their seats around the conference table. A court reporter, her steno machine between her knees, her laptop on the desk, and her microphone in the middle of the table, sat poised to take down all of the questions, answers, and lawyers posturing. Catherine sat at the end of the table, a legal pad and a stack of documents before her. Walter Jenkins sat to her right, his well-manicured hands folded on the table. Kelson raised his right hand and swore to tell the truth.
"Mr. Kelson," Catherine said, "would you please say your full name for the record?"
"Victor Wallace Kelson."
"Are you an officer of Kelson Manufacturing, Inc.?"
"I'm the president."
"Are you also a shareholder?"
100%.
"What is the business of Kelson Manufacturing?"
"You mean what was the business? We sold it."
"Very well. What was the business before you sold it?"
"We manufactured and sold packaging materials. Why does any of that matter? Where's my money?"
"Who is Dennis Harrington?"
"Kelson Manufacturing's CFO.
Was he involved in the sale of your company?"
Kelson looked at his lawyer and made a face as if to say, "Is she kidding?"
"Mr. Kelson," Catherine said, "he can't answer the questions for you. You have to answer them yourself."
"Yeah, he was involved. Of course he was involved. Maybe too involved because he got himself killed."
"What were his responsibilities with regard to the sale of your company?"
"He was working directly with Walter Jenkins, or whoever Jenkins assigned to do the paperwork. How the hell do I know? He did what had to be done. That's why I paid him."
"As far as you know, did Mr. Harrington review and approve all the paperwork?"
"Yeah."
"All of the loan documents?"
"Right."
"All of the financials?"
"Right."
"Because that's what you were paying him to do?"
"Exactly."
"Including reviewing and approving all of the escrow paperwork?"
"Oh, I see where you're going. Mr. Summers reviewed them too. Kelson Manufacturing was paying exorbitant legal fees to this man over there."
Kelson pointed a stiff finger in Jenkins's direction.
"To protect us so we wouldn't be cheated out of our money."
Kelson stood up.
"You were supposed to protect me, you pompous fuck."
"Look at him in his fancy suit. Fancy paneled office offers me a cigar. Goody two-shoes asshole."
"Really, Mr. Russell?" Catherine said calmly. "Do you think you might control your client and remind him of the decorum of a deposition and that these outbursts are on the record?" Kelson's attorney gave a small tug on Kelson's jacket.
"Sit down, Vic. There'll be plenty of time for motion later."
"That's not good enough," Catherine said. "Mr. Kelson, we're not in a courtroom, but according to the rules, the examination and cross-examination in a deposition are to proceed as they would at trial. For example, the same rules of perjury apply. Everything you say today is being memorialized in the stenographic record, including your abusive tirade of a moment ago. If you refuse to conduct yourself in a civil manner, I will have the court reporter transcribe this proceeding and present it to the judge with a request that you be held in contempt. Are we clear?" Kelson turned his head and looked out the window. "Are we clear, Mr. Kelson?"
He flicked his head nonchalantly.
"Yeah."
"Fine. Do you claim that someone stole your company's money?"
"What are you, crazy? You know they did. $88 million. I was supposed to have a profit of $96 million, but I only ended up with $8 million. Jenkins let some slimy lawyer steal the money that was supposed to pay off Exchange Bank. I had to make that payment myself out of my net profits."
"What slimy lawyer stole your money?"
"Summers did. Or he let someone else, I don't know."
"Do you have any evidence that Summers took the money?" said Catherine.
"No, but I don't have to. It was Jenkins' job to protect me."
"Was it Jenkins and Fairchild's job to protect you from yourself?"
"What are you talking about?
Who was Mr. Harrington's boss?"
"I was."
"I understand that Mr. Harrington went missing right after the closing, and you couldn't find him. Is that right?"
"Yeah. Him and Summers, both of them."
"Did Mr. Harrington take any of that money?"
"How the hell do I know?"
"Exactly my point. You don't know whether Mr. Harrington, Mr. Ellis, Mr. Summers, or some other person managed to misdirect the wired funds, do you?"
"It doesn't matter. I hired Walter Jenkins. Jenkins was supposed to protect me from all enemies, foreign and domestic."
Interesting you should use that phrase. Speaking of foreign enemies, do you know a man named Dimitri? Catherine noticed that Kelson's body twitched and he blinked hard. Dimitri who? That's what I'm asking. Do you know a man named Dimitri? I know a lot of people. What's his last name? How many Dimitris do you know? He turned to his lawyer. Can I get a glass of water here? A silver pitcher sat on a tray in the middle of the table. Catherine gestured toward it. Help yourself. Kelson poured a glass of water. His hand shook slightly. He took a sip and placed it down. I don't know any Dimitri. Dimitri who? Does he go by another name, maybe? I wouldn't know. Just so the record is clear, under oath, subject to penalties for perjury, you are stating that you are not acquainted with any person named Dimitri, correct? Dimitri who? Dimitri who? I don't know. I meet a lot of people. Maybe once I met someone named Dimitri. I understand, Mr. Kelson, that you are quite the basketball fan. Is that right? Does this have something to do with the money that was stolen from me? Was it stolen by a basketball player? Kelson laughed nervously and looked at his lawyer, who shrugged. I guess that all depends on your definition of player, doesn't it? Catherine said. What does that mean? Well, some might refer to people who gamble on basketball games as players. What are you insinuating? Why, nothing at all. I just asked if you were a basketball fan. I had heard that you attend all the St. Joseph games. I'm not answering any stupid questions about basketball. I sued Jenkins for the money that was stolen. Ask your questions about that. You're irrelevant, immaterial, and unconstitutional. Did you and Dimitri bet on basketball games? Kelson's face turned deep red. He screamed at his lawyer. Russell, are you going to do something, or are you going to let her throw shit at me all afternoon? Ms. Lockhart, your questions are abusive and harassing. This deposition is being conducted in bad faith, in a manner designed to embarrass and oppress the deponent. Betting on basketball, really? Unless you confine your questions to the issue at hand, we will seek a protective order. This is my deposition, Mr. Russell, and I will decide which questions to ask. How does betting on basketball have anything to do with this case? I don't see the need to educate you on my theories, Mr. Russell, but I'm sure you realize that in fraud and embezzlement cases, the claimant's financial condition is material. Accordingly, his gambling activities may very well lead to relevant information. You're gonna let her tell you what to do? Kelson said to his lawyer. She has a point, Vic. We have to let her ask a few questions in that area. The rules don't permit me to instruct you not to answer a question on the basis of relevance. Then Russell turned to Catherine and spoke brusquely. But we will not countenance abuse and harassment. Catherine tapped her pencil. Let's get back to basketball. Did you go to the St. Joe game with Dimitri? No, I don't know any Dimitri. But maybe I met one once, but I don't go to games with any Dimitris. Are you acquainted with Darius McCord? Kelson swallowed audibly. He plays for the Deacons. Well, not since his injury. Have you ever met Darius McCord? Probably at some booster event. I'm not sure. Are you acquainted with a man named Yevgeny? Kelson shook his head. He reached for his glass of water, but tipped it over. Catherine placed a stack of napkins on the table. Let's get back to Yevgeny, Mr. Kelson. Do you know him? Russell, do something, will you? He snapped at his lawyer. Russell shrugged. Just answer the question, Vic. Tell her if you know a man named Yevgeny. I don't know any Yevgenys. I don't know any Dimitris. I don't know Darius McCord except maybe from the basketball luncheons. I'm not answering any more of your bullshit questions. Kelson stood, grabbed his coat, and headed for the door, but stopped before his lawyer. Why don't you object, Russell? That's your fucking job. Irrelevant and immaterial. Abusive and harassing. What a dog shit lawyer you are. File a petition to protect me. Kelson stormed out of the office. When he reached the street, Kelson pulled out his phone. His fingers shook so badly he could barely dial. Hello, Dimitri. Dimitri! Damn it, answer the phone! Call me back, we got serious problems. They're asking about the games. He paused. Fuck it. I'll see you later. Chapter 64. Marcy sat with her stack of magazines in room 8 of Queen's ICU. Bundles of tubes and wires hooked unconscious Jack Summers to a panel of monitors. Doctors thought it best that he stay sedated for the first few days in order to manage the pain and reduce movement. Nevertheless, Marcy kept vigil, leaving his bedside only to grab a sandwich or to use the ladies' room. From time to time, she'd rub his arm, wipe his brow, or hold his hand. Even though he slept soundly, she would talk to him.
"It's gonna be okay. You're gonna pull through this. You're a fighter. The bravest man I know."
She stared at the monitors as if they were TV screens. Green heartbeats popping up and down. Summers' breathing was slow and deep. She squeezed his hand.
"Well, I sure got myself mixed up in a fine mess. Fallen from a best friend's husband, who just happens to be a guy wanted by the police and the Russian mob. I can't say you didn't warn me. You said, 'Marcy, get out now,' but did Marcy listen? Nope. Should have trusted my instincts and said, 'Goodbye, Jack, or Eugene, or whoever you're calling yourself today.' But you knew I couldn't do that, didn't you? You knew I was just as committed to rescuing Sophie as you were. But I didn't have to fall in love. That was my own doing. I should never have had that second bottle of Grenache. I think that was my Rubicon. Way before the fisherman wedding. Down goes Marcy."
She stood to stretch her legs and walked to the other side of the bed.
"Is it totally naive to believe that when this is over, the government will clear you? Liam said there's a play for you. If the government wants your help, they're going to have to pay for it. They cut people deals all the time. Immunity, pardon, clemency, whatever the hell they call it."
She wiped his brow and kissed his cheek.
"So maybe it's not so crazy to think we'll be together. You, me, Sophie. We could get a house. Maybe out on the North Shore, one with a big backyard. And, of course, a piano. Maybe Sophie could have a brother. What do you think?"
She kissed him again.
"Liam and Kayla, I have faith in them. It's gonna work out, Jack. We're going to get Sophie, and we're going to make a life together."
She looked at his sleeping face and smiled.
"You don't have to say yes right now."
Early in the morning, Liam stopped in to visit Summers. Marcy set her magazine on the table and greeted him with a hug.
"How's he doing?"
"I don't know,"
she said with a catch in her throat. A tear rolled down her cheek.
"They're giving him a lot of drugs."
She pointed to the patient monitor.
"But his heartbeat is steady and his breathing is good."
Liam smiled and nodded.
"He's still listed as critical, but the doctors said he thought he was stabilizing." "That's a good sign, right?"
Liam put his arm around her.
"I'm sure it is.
Has he been conscious at all today?" Marcy shook her head.
"They don't want him to be conscious. You know, the pain. They said maybe in a few days. Is that policeman still sitting in the hallway?"
Liam nodded. "As far as we know, the two men in the Cadillac are still at large. They tried once, they could try again."
"Where's Kayla?"
"Haven't seen her yet today. She was headed to the federal building for a meeting."
"Why don't you go home for a while, Marcy?
Or at least take a walk. I'll stay with Jack." Marcy smiled.
"Thanks, but I'm fine. I picked up a turkey sandwich and I'm just sitting here reading. It's okay. Really."
It was nearly sunset when Kayla strolled into the beach bar at the Mona Surfrider and found Liam sitting at the far end of the veranda, where the brick pavers met the sand. He watched her approach on confident steps. The combination of the evening breeze and the diaphanous fabric caused her pastel blue sundress to hug her shapely legs and accent the contour of her stride.
"I just came from the hospital."
Liam pulled a chair over for her.
"I was there earlier. Any change in his condition?"
She shook her head. and her shoulder-length black hair danced and tousled in the gusts of the evening trade winds.
No, he's pretty much the same. I spoke with his doctors. They're going to take him off sedation tomorrow.
Tomorrow? I thought they said a few days.
Kayla leaned forward and spoke in a whispered voice. Liam, we need him now. We've received disturbing news from Hebron. Whatever Al-Zahani's group is planning, it's set to occur on Yom Ha'atzma'ut, 9 days away. That's Israel's Independence Day, and several celebrations are scheduled. We can't let it happen.
How do you know that?
The bug I placed at the bakery.
What else do you know?
She shook her head. Pieces of information, not enough to provide any clear answers. Something about 2,000 bags that have been delivered to a warehouse in Jerusalem. Bags of what, we don't know. The location of the warehouse, we don't know. Initially, we thought the bags would contain component parts to be assembled somewhere for a WMD, or a bunch of IEDs. But the conspirators talked about each bag having a single victim. 300 extra bags would mean 300 dead enemies, they said. And they talked about using surplus bags for a future operation in Tel Aviv.
So you think each bag contains a single weapon?
She nodded. There are more bags being manufactured by Al-Zahani. He said he can make 40 a day. And I'm certain that is all being done in that outbuilding in his compound.
Do we have any intelligence that Al-Zahani is a munitions expert?
No. He spent his entire professional life in a white coat. Medical school, laboratories, hospitals. But that doesn't mean he can't be supervising munitions construction.
What about chemicals?
Could be. But why describe them as bags? Toxic chemicals would be dispersed from cylinders, warheads, spray tanks. And chemical dispersion in the air or the water wouldn't focus on a single victim. The conspirator said 300 more bags means 300 more victims.
What about biological?
He's a doctor and a lab scientist.
What if he's growing germs?
Well, we've thought about that, but we've dismissed it. There are insurmountable challenges for a small Palestinian group like the Sons of Canaan to use biological weaponry. An effective dispersal mechanism, storage, a delivery medium. It'd have to be introduced through the food chain, water supply, even atmospheric.
You don't disperse germs from a bag.
All of the toxins we know about that are suitable for such a small operation would be largely ineffective. They certainly would not be thought of in terms of one bag, one victim.
Yet Al-Zahani said he could produce 40 a day?
Right, 40 bags. I have to get into Al-Zahani's compound. I know the answers lie in that one-story building.
Why doesn't the IDF just go in there? They can certainly manage to get through the walls of a Hebron residence. I mean, we're not talking about breaching the Kremlin.
Kayla shook her head. He's rigged the building to explode. He said on the recording that he could instantly firebomb the building if he was attacked. And we know he's got a sophisticated security system. If an Israeli police force or Israeli soldiers were to attempt an entry by force, if they tripped the alarm, he'd detonate the building. Then we'd never know what he was producing. But it's worse than that. 2,000 devices are already sitting in a Jerusalem warehouse. The breach would only prompt the terrorists to move up the attack. We need Al-Zahani alive. He knows all the players and how it's all going down.
She shook her head again.
We need to get into the compound peacefully, pretextually. For that, we need Summers, awake and walking. It's the only way.
What did his doctor say?
What do you think? He said it's too risky to get him up. He said no traveling. What did you expect?
You told him to take Summers off sedation, didn't you?
Kayla nodded.
I had to.
What if he doesn't make it? Then you and I will have to find a way inside.
Kayla stared at Liam's tumbler of scotch.
Aren't you going to offer to buy a girl a drink?
Liam smiled.
I'll do better than that. I'll buy her some dinner.
Liam called the server over, and they ordered the catch of the day and a bottle of Sauvignon Blanc. A glass of wine or two, a few laughs, and some small talk later, and Kayla asked,
Did you get Catherine to come out here?
Liam shook his head.
She said she might, but I don't think she will.
Kayla raised her eyebrows.
Jealousy? Or is it something else?
I don't know. Things aren't going as well as they should right now. Maybe it's the lawsuit, maybe it's jealousy. Maybe she's got something on her mind. But there's no doubt she's backpedaling from where we've been. You know, acting a little standoffish. I must have pissed her off somehow.
Then why don't you just bring her out here? The enchantment of the islands. They say it works magic on broken romances.
Tell the truth, I think if she came out here, it'd be uncomfortable.
Kayla took a sip of wine and stared at Liam with raised eyebrows as if to say,
because?
Liam squirmed a little.
You know, it's just the sense I get. Lately, when I've tried to talk seriously with her, she's backed away.
And now you're worried about her level of commitment?
Well, I never was before, but maybe I am now. It's just a feeling I get. I could be wrong. Yesterday she told me we made such a good couple.
What's wrong with that? You don't believe her?
No, I do think we make a good couple. But then I asked her if she really thought so, and she sounded shocked and pissed and said, of course.
Kayla scrunched her face.
Wait. She said you two made a good couple, and you asked her if she meant it? And you're questioning her commitment?
I guess that was a dumb thing to say, but it just popped out. There shouldn't be any question in my mind, but there is.
Maybe in her mind it's your commitment that's in question.
Liam poured another glass of wine for each of them.
Why? I give her no cause to doubt me. What basis does she have to feel insecure?
I can think of a few. You came out to Hawaii, her dream destination, with another woman, one that she sees as a rival.
A rival? You? Seriously?
Oh, thanks very much.
I didn't mean it that way.
You certainly could be anyone's rival, a smart, beautiful woman like you. It's just that I don't think...
He paused.
Do you really think that's it?
Follow me. You told me that she'd been betrayed. I think you used the word blindsided by her ex-husband and his multiple affairs.
And criminal activities.
Kayla nodded. Now she's involved with you, an old dear friend, one who couldn't pull the trigger when she was younger. The one man she really wanted to marry when she was young turned out to be too insecure to even ask her out.
Now, wait, no, you wait.
You've been sweethearts since high school. That's more than 20 years. And now you've been together for over a year and you still haven't popped the question. And maybe you never will. And why do you suppose that is?
He shrugged and shook his head.
It's only been a year or so.
Is that too long?
I didn't want to rush her. I just never thought she was in a hurry.
And once you put it to you directly, about the tide in the affairs of men, God, what could be more direct? You told me you totally dropped the ball. So, in her mind, maybe you never will marry her. Maybe it's your commitment that needs to be questioned here.
Mine? I don't think so.
Do you still have your apartment?
I do, but I stay with her most of the time.
Why are you putting me through a paper shredder? I've asked her a couple of times if she wanted to have a discussion about her future.
Oh, you romantic devil.
Why don't you offer to prepare a memorandum? You know, you could exchange deal points.
Kayla smiled impishly and took a sip of wine.
Here's a clue. I don't think she's looking for discussions.
Liam nodded.
I know you're right. She told me when the time is right, she wants it done with pomp and circumstance.
So you think I should be more direct?
Kayla shook her head. No. What I think is, you need to do some self-evaluation. You need to decide if you want to marry her, and if you do, you should go out, buy her a ring, and do it right. Or quit complaining.
Liam tightened his lips and nodded pensively. He pretended to hold a microphone to his mouth and said,
Folks, we're visiting tonight with Kayla Cummings, international spy and advisor to the Lovelorn.
Kayla winked. Go buy the ring. If she turns you down, who knows? It might not be the end of the world. I might make a play for you.
She smiled.
Liam reached for the check, but Kayla stopped him. This one's on me. I've given you a hard time. I'd like you to join Harry and me for a video conference tomorrow. I'll pick you up at 3:30.
Okay. A.M.
3:30 in the morning?
Right. Israel is 12 hours ahead, and we need you to call Jamal Abu Hamad.
She signed the check, leaned over, gave Liam a kiss on the cheek, and turned to leave.
Good night, Irish.
Liam watched her as she walked away, her shapely silhouette sashaying in the moonlight. He took a deep breath, signaled for the server, and ordered another drink.
Satellite images over the past month do not show any trucks entering or leaving Al-Zahani's residence, Harry said by video conference.
Kayla sat beside Liam and stared at grainy satellite shots of the compound on the computer screen.
What about loading bags into the trunk of Al-Zahani's car, or someone else's car? Maybe they transported the bags piecemeal, she said.
If he loaded anything into his Mercedes, we didn't catch it, Harry responded. But again, anything transported to Jerusalem in the truck of a car would be discovered at the checkpoint.
What about the workers? Could they take them out piece by piece and drive them to a central location?
Harry pursed his lips and nodded.
Well, there's a parking area to the west of his building where the workers park their vehicles. If they've been transporting these bags one at a time out of the compound, they've been pretty smart because we haven't caught it.
So if he's manufactured something in his building and transported it to a central location to be stored in a Jerusalem warehouse,
we have no idea how he did it or where it is.
Or what it is?
Or what it is.
Then we have to assume they slipped the weapons past us.
Harry nodded.
That's the obvious conclusion. 2,000 of them are sitting in a warehouse.
Kayla turned to Liam and put a hand on his shoulder.
It's up to you, Irish. The answers are inside the walls. The ransom exchange is our best chance of getting inside without risking the demolition of the laboratory. We need to set up the exchange as soon as possible. It's 4:30 p.m. in Jerusalem. Do you have Abu Hamad's number?
Liam fished the paper from his wallet. He reached over the desk for the landline phone, but Kayla put her hand over the handset.
His caller ID needs to show your cell phone.
Liam dialed Jamal's number, but the call went to voicemail. Jamal, this is Liam Taggart. I'm sitting with Jack Summers, and he has a briefcase full of money for Dr. Al-Zahani. I know it's an imposition, but you are my only contact with the doctor. Can I ask you to put me in touch with him or one of his friends to arrange the exchange? Please call me back. Thank you for your help.
So, now we wait, Kayla said.
Harry nodded.
Keep me in the loop.
Liam stood to leave and his phone buzzed. The text message said,
Booked a morning flight to Honolulu. Meet me at the airport at 3:15 p.m. Love you. Kat.
He showed the message to Kayla.
She smiled. Don't screw this one up, Irish. I need a partner with his head on straight.
Chapter 65. The Holy Land tours bus pulled into the parking lot at the Tomb of the Patriarchs as it did twice each week. 23 passengers alighted, cameras hanging from their shoulders, guidebooks in their hands. One by one, they lined up to go through the metal detectors and into the shrine. Aziz smiled at each of the tourists, informing them that the bus would depart in 2 hours. When the last one headed up the steps, Aziz checked his phone and saw the following text message. Cancel the pickup. Meet me at the corner of the plaza.
Aziz locked his bus and made his way toward a man sitting on a bench.
We're not shipping any more IV bags, Aziz,
Al-Zahani said.
Why not? Everything is working smoothly. I get through the checkpoint each week without a problem.
I know. Allah has favored us. But it is the collective decision of the group to cease the transport of any more bags. They have decided to be extra cautious. There'll be no pickups today. We will start again in a few months. Aziz smiled broadly.
I saw Sami yesterday. The Israelis, they do not suspect he's one of us. They call him Sami or Shmuel. Mediterranean Medical Supply trusts him completely. He runs his delivery route every day without any suspicion. On the 16th, he will load his truck with Mediterranean's IV bags, bring them to the warehouse, swap them out for hours, and complete his delivery to the hospitals, just as we have planned. Our bags will be unloaded and put into use before anyone discovers the difference.
Is Sami sure he will be assigned to deliver IV bags that day?
Of course, Arif. They deliver IV sets to hospitals every day.
But are we sure Sami will be assigned to deliver the IVs and not some other driver?
Aziz smiled widely, showing a gap between his two front teeth.
It is all worked out, my friend. Mediterranean has 3 delivery trucks, 2 of which will unfortunately encounter mechanical difficulties. Do not concern yourself with the deliveries. Your responsibility was the manufacture of the poison. You have done well.
Thank you.
The poison?
Aziz asked with a sly grin.
Will it cause a panic?
Oh, yes, it will.
And they will not discover the source immediately?
No, my friend. It has a slow incubation period. That's the beauty. I myself have designed this organism. For a few days, the victim is totally unaware of the toxin. Most will have left the hospital and returned home before there are any signs. Then they'll think they have the flu. After a few days, when the victim becomes very ill, it's too late. The bacteria have done their work. No antidote, no antibiotic can reverse the internal damage. And it's unlikely the hospitals will ever discover that the toxins were contained in the IVs. They will have already disposed of the empty bags.
Arif, you are a genius.
Sophie skipped along the sidewalk, Bashir close behind. He smiled warmly at her.
You are so much like your mother, full of boundless joy.
Did you know my mother?
Oh, child, I walked with her as I walk with you. When I shut my eyes, it is as though I have picked up little Alina from her madrasa. She skipped along just like you.
Did you love her?
Very, very much. I would have done anything to keep her from harm.
Sophie looked down and kicked a stone on the sidewalk.
Why did she have to die?
Bashir shook his head, but smiled.
She was so sweet that Allah must have wanted her close to him, to keep him company and make him smile.
Jadi says she died because she had turned from Allah. He says she turned away from her faith.
Well, that is your Jadi. Myself, I do not believe it is true. Your mother was pure in heart and could never have offended Allah. She was sweet and loving.
He touched the tip of Sophie's nose.
Just like you.
My mother used to call me her little butterfly.
Sophie looked up at Bashir.
Do you like butterflies?
He looked down and nodded.
Oh, of course. But I do not see many in our part of Hebron. Perhaps because there are not many gardens.
I wish I was a butterfly.
But you're such a pretty girl. Why do you want to be a butterfly?
They can fly so high. They can go wherever they like. Walls cannot stop them.
They entered the home and Al-Zahani greeted Sophie with a hug.
I have a chocolate for you.
She sat on her grandfather's lap and drank from a small cup.
I love Bashir. He's very kind.
Al-Zahani smiled.
Kind and strong and brave.
Is he like a strong warrior?
Sophie took a sip of chocolate, leaving her with a brown mustache, which she wiped with the back of her hand.
Exactly. Like a strong Canaanite warrior. Come with me, Sophie.
He held her hand and led her to the wall of the library. He pointed to a black and white photo of a smiling man in a white pillbox hat. He picked up the child and held her high so that she could get a good look.
That is my beloved grandfather, Ibrahim al-Zahani, the greatest warrior of them all. He is your great-great-grandfather. His magnificent blood runs through your veins. For many years, he led our people and fought against our enemies. He even defended our homes right here in Hebron.
This home?
Well, not this very home, but our neighborhood. It was back in the summer of 1929. People were coming to our land from faraway countries. They wanted to settle here, even though it wasn't their land. They were moving into our cities, buying up our homes, threatening to change our way of life. Many of them were Jews and did not worship Allah, and many of these Jews had come from Europe. They called themselves Ashkenazis,
The Grand Mufti of Jerusalem warned them, told them not to come, told them to leave, but they would not listen. One day there was a fight outside the mosque in Jerusalem, and 3 Arab boys were killed. Arab families were afraid for their lives. The Mufti sent Grandfather Ibrahim to Hebron. "Get the Ashkenazis out of Hebron," he ordered Grandfather. "Tell our people about the dangerous invaders. Protect our women and children." Ibrahim gathered the bravest warriors in Hebron and took up arms, whatever they had. Some had guns, but others only had clubs or axes. No matter. The Jews were no match for us. Many tried to hide, but Ibrahim found them all. Finally, the British police came and took the Jews from Hebron to Jerusalem. There were no more Jews left in Hebron. Ibrahim had done his job. He had made his Mufti proud. That was called the Great Hebron Liberation.
Was Bashir one of those brave warriors?
Al-Zahani laughed.
No, he was not even born yet. Neither was I.
Al-Zahani pointed to another black and white photograph. This one of a man with his arm around a boy.
Do you know who these people are, Sophie?
She shook her head.
Well, that is my father, Hamid, your great-grandfather. Can you guess who he's holding?
Sophie pointed to Arif.
Right. It's me.
He planted a kiss on the top of her head.
Was your father brave too?
Oh, child, the bravest of them all. He fought the British. He fought the foreign settlers. He fought alongside our warriors in 1948, and after we won, he was put in charge of the army battalion stationed right here in Hebron. He was a respected leader in our town. He built this house for us.
What happened to your father?
He was murdered by Israeli soldiers in 1967.
Were you very sad when he died?
I am still very sad. But I have vowed to carry on the ideals of my father and grandfather. To this day, I honor their memories.
He turned and walked back to the sofa, where the cups of chocolate were placed.
Someday, Sophie, you will have the honor of carrying on the work of the Al-Zahanis.
Chapter 66.
Marcy.
Curled up in the chair beside Jack's hospital bed, Marcy awoke quickly. She smiled.
Hi,
she whispered in a sleepy voice. Reflexively, she scanned the patient monitor. His vitals were steady.
How are you feeling?
Groggy. A little achy, just fine if I don't move. Have you been here the whole time?
Pretty much.
He smiled.
You just won't give up.
No, I won't.
Thank you.
She scooted her chair close to the bed and reached for his hand.
I want you to get better so we can go climbing mountains in our sandals.
Jack reacted with a short chuckle and grimaced from a sharp pain.
Where are Taggart and the State Department woman?
Oh, they're still around. I'm sure they'll come over today.
What day is it?
April 8th.
Wow. I've been asleep for 3 days.
The nurse came into the room with her monitoring equipment and Marcy stepped out. When she returned, they had raised Jack's bed to a sitting position. He was sipping from a styrofoam cup.
The nurse told me that the doctor decided to take me off sedation. And he wants me to try to practice getting in and out of a wheelchair.
Marcy pursed her lips.
I know. That was Kayla's idea.
I have to warn you, Kayla intends to fly you to Israel as soon as she can arrange it.
That's good. I need to get Sophie.
Marcy shook her head.
The doctor doesn't think so, and neither do I. You had serious injuries and you lost a lot of blood. Don't go yet. Just tell them you need a little more time.
I can't. If I don't cooperate, I won't get any consideration from the court.
That's right,
Kayla said, walking into the room carrying a large purse and a newspaper. I'm glad you understand. Liam followed her in.
I'm fine, thank you for asking, Jack said.
Sorry, she said. How are you feeling?
Shitty.
Kayla looked at his chart. You're improving.
Since when are you a doctor?
Jack said.
I hear you want me to go to Hebron right away.
I'm afraid I do.
When?
Kayla pulled up a chair.
Soon. We're waiting to hear that the arrangements have been made to exchange the money. It could be as soon as tomorrow.
That's ridiculous, Marcy said. Are you trying to kill him?
Don't, Marcy.
I need to go when they want me to.
But you can't even get out of bed.
Jack shrugged.
The doctors told me they want me to sit in a wheelchair.
If you're going, I'm going with you, Marcy said.
Kayla shook her head.
She can't go with us, Jack. It's a dangerous mission. He needs my help.
Talk to her, Kayla said to Jack.
She doesn't belong over there.
She's right, Marcy. I need to do this myself.
I can help with Sophie.
I'm her Aunt Marcy.
Tears rolled out of her eyes and her jaw quivered.
Jack, look at you. You can barely sit up. Don't shut me out of this, please.
He shrugged.
Can she go part of the way, Kayla? As long as she stays out of danger? I'm not exactly marathon ready. Are you going to nursemaid me?
Kayla paced by the foot of the bed.
It's a bad idea. It's a dangerous intelligence op.
There's just no room for you, Marcy. I'm sorry.
Liam held up a hand.
Maybe we can work this out. Why don't we let Marcy go part of the way, maybe to Tel Aviv?
What harm can that do?
Kayla thought for a moment and walked to the bedside.
All right, here's the deal. If you'll make the effort, do whatever you can to get yourself ready, even if we have to leave in a day or two, I'll let Marcy go as far as Tel Aviv, not all the way to Hebron.
Deal.
Jack held Marcy's hand.
Now, if you two wouldn't mind giving us a few minutes alone, there's nothing that needs to be done right now.
Sure.
Kayla handed the Honolulu newspaper to Jack.
There's something I want you to see first.
The newspaper was folded back to a story on page 12 entitled, Suspect Killed in Prison Rumble.
While Summers read the story, Kayla said, We thought it better to run a story that you died in a knife fight. They haven't caught up with the two men in the Cadillac. The man who stabbed you, a Russian national on an expired student visa, isn't talking. His lawyer and two other inmates swear that he acted in self-defense. So, officially, Eugene Wilson is dead.
Well, that's the second time he's died.
Jack put the paper down.
It's freaky to read your own obituary.
Kayla nodded.
I didn't want either of you to be surprised. I'll leave you two alone.
Kayla and Liam left and shut the door behind them. In the hallway, Kayla said,
Thanks for your help in there. And I think you're right.
Marcy will be a calming influence until we have to go into Hebron.
You're welcome.
So,
Catherine's coming in this afternoon. Are you going shopping?
You're being a little pushy, aren't you?
Kayla smiled.
I just don't want to go to Hebron and have my partner all worried about his love life.
God, you are a tough woman. She shrugged. When Kayla and Liam had left, Jack beckoned Marcy to sit down.
I know what you've been thinking. That everything is going to work out for the two of us. But the odds are stacked against us. Kayla's right about the dangers. The Palestinians don't want to exchange Sophie. They just want to see if they can make a quick score. They'll try to kill me and take the money. I've already been stabbed in the back by a Russian, probably Dimitri's man. And even if the exchange all worked out and I came back alive, it's likely I'll spend the next 10 or 20 years in prison. I want us to be together as much as you do. But we need to look at the realities.
Gosh, Jack, I never considered any of that.
What's wrong with you that you're planning a future, a house and children, with a man who has no future?
Marcy stood with her hands on her hips.
You sneak. You eavesdropped on me. You were pretending to be asleep.
Pretending?
She smiled and pointed her finger.
Well, I'm just not going to accept a dead end. I'm going with you, and I'm bringing you and Sophie back. And somehow, this will work out.
Catherine's plane was delayed for over 4 hours. She finally landed at Honolulu International at 7:30 p.m., 13 hours after she took off from Chicago. Her watch, still on Central Daylight Time, read 11:30 p.m. The reunion with Liam at the baggage carousel was joyous and emotional.
I feel like it's been a year since we've seen each other, she said, with her arms around his neck.
I'm so glad you decided to fly out.
Why did you change your mind? I heard something in your voice that I didn't like. I just figured we had some talking to do.
Did Kayla call you?
What? What's Kayla got to do with this?
Nothing, just... never mind.
Is there something going on here, Liam?
No, absolutely not.
Kayla picked up on the fact that there was some tension between us, that's all. Please, don't stress about Kayla. She is strictly business, okay?
She nodded.
Okay. I'm sorry if I worried you on the phone.
Are you hungry?
Starving. I refuse to buy that airplane food.
There's a great outdoor grill at our hotel.
Liam gave her a squeeze, grabbed her suitcase, and let her out the door. It's so good to see you.
Liam and Catherine sat at the Mona Surf Riders grill studying the dinner menus. Behind them, waves broke loudly on the shore, and above them, birds squawked in the palm trees. Ambient noise, loud enough to strain conversation. To Catherine, Liam seemed to be more nervous than usual.
Is something wrong? Catherine said.
Liam shook his head, but he was obviously about to say something. He leaned forward and cleared his throat.
You okay? Catherine said.
He reached across the table and covered Catherine's hand gently with his own. He looked into her eyes, took a deep breath, and cleared his throat again.
Catherine, you know I love you, and there's no other person in my life. I have something I want to ask you.
Just then, a familiar voice interrupted them.
Hello there, you two.
Catherine responded flatly.
Hello, Kayla.
May I?
She pulled a chair over to join them.
So, you got a text from Abu Hamad?
Liam sighed and nodded. He passed his phone across the table to Kayla, who read the message.
I have spoken to Arif. I have his terms. Please call me at 10 a.m. my time.
Kayla looked at her watch.
That's in 45 minutes.
She motioned to the waiter and ordered a glass of Chardonnay.
I saw Summers again. He looks pretty good. They want him to try sitting in a wheelchair.
Liam shook his head. So you can roll him down the streets of Hebron? Is that your version of dead man walking?
Very funny. The doctor says he can fly out there, take his wheelchair with him. He'll be fine.
Fine? He can barely move.
I need your help here, Liam.
And if he's not ready?
I would think the last thing you want is a relapse.
Kayla looked at her watch and spoke quietly.
Today is the 8th. Yom Ha'atzmaut, the target date, is little more than a week away. We can't waste a minute. It takes almost a full day to travel. The exchange must be scheduled at the earliest possible time. We have to push Summers' recovery.
And if he can't make it?
Kayla bit her lip and took a healthy drink of wine.
He has to make it.
At 10 o'clock, Liam placed the call from his hotel room.
Hello, my friend, Abu Hamad said. How are things in Chicago?
Cold and windy as usual. And in Jerusalem?
My shop is very comfortable.
I'm surprised you spoke directly to Arif.
I am also surprised. I was speaking with Fakir. But when it came down to the details of exchanging money, Arif called me.
I thought the two of you didn't speak.
We did not. We still do not. The conversation was mechanical, devoid of cordiality. Nevertheless, he communicated his terms and hung up.
I see. I apologize for putting you in such an awkward position.
You did not put me. I put myself.
I thank you for that.
His terms are simple. The father, John Summers, is to come alone to a bakery in Hebron on April 25th. is to bring $5 million in U.S. currency or the equivalent amount in euros. Non-consecutive bills. Following delivery and examination of the money, the child will be brought to the bakery and Summers may leave with her.
One moment, please, Jamal. Liam put the call on mute and explained the terms to Kayla.
No way, it has to be before the 16th. Try for the 12th, and not at the bakery. A straight exchange at Al Zahani's, in his home. We need to get inside those walls.
Liam nodded. Jamal, my friend, we need to modify those terms a little. Would it be possible for you to communicate our desires back to Arif?
I can talk to Fakir. He will tell Arif to call me.
What changes would you have to his terms?
First, Mr. Summers has had an unfortunate accident. He's been seriously injured and is recovering from surgery. He cannot walk. He's in a wheelchair and requires assistance. I will accompany him along with his nurse. As to the exchange, he wants a direct swap. Money for Sophie, same place, simultaneously. No Sophie, no money. And he does not want it at a public location, both for Sophie's well-being and his own. Mr. Summers will meet Al Zahani at the doctor's home, where he will take possession of the child and her things. And Jamal, please tell him this is most important. I'm going to pack the briefcase for Mr. Summers. It'll have $5 million in it, but it will also have an explosive device. If some guy grabs the case and tries to open it without the correct combination, the case will explode and the contents will be destroyed, not to mention the guy who tries to open it. It's not that I don't trust the good doctor, but it may just discourage one of his friends from trying to finance an early retirement. Only Mr. Summers can open the briefcase. Make sure Arif understands this. Finally, my friend, Mr. Summers is most anxious to recover his daughter, the sooner the better. He has the money in his possession and would like to make the exchange in 4 days. We will make arrangements to be at Arif's home on April 12th. Jamal, we are indebted to you for interceding on our behalf. I'm sure that Mr. Summers will express great interest in Middle Eastern antiquities.
Abu Hamad laughed. Antiquities for certain. I do not seek profit from my assistance. But if Mr. Summers should find his way to my shop, I will gladly show him a few precious items.
You are a good friend, Jamal.
I understand. I will make sure Arif receives your terms. Goodbye, my friend.
Liam hung up and nodded at Kayla.
I need a moment with Liam, Kayla said to Catherine, and she took him out into the hallway.
So now we wait again, Kayla said to Liam quietly.
What if Arif doesn't respond? I don't want the IDF storming the compound. Abu Hamad's got to get us in.
$5 million? He'll respond.
We'll get in, but I want to make sure we get out.
How much support is the agency devoted to this operation? Men and materiel?
Kayla shrugged. I don't know for certain. That's not under my control.
Well, we need an operations expert to manage this ruse de guerre. You and I are not equipped.
I'm sure we'll get all the help we need. Don't worry.
Don't worry? Do you remember when we sat around Jenkins and Fairchild's conference table weeks ago?
We need you to make the exchange, Liam. We want you to be the go-between.
Do you remember that?
Of course.
Skillfully omitted from that conversation was the part where good old Liam was informed that there was an imminent terrorist strike, and that good old Liam was expected to walk into a firing squad.
I told you Al Zahani was a terrorist. I told you the Beehive was active.
And Harry told me it was theoretical, that he hadn't committed any assets to the project. Kayla, we cannot do this without proper support. We need to know where his guards are stationed and how they're armed. We need aerial surveillance, and not just satellite. Like a couple of those hummingbird drones, and backup. Lots of backup.
She nodded. I'm sure it's all arranged. If we go into Hebron with Summers carrying a suitcase full of money, we're targets the moment that suitcase is opened.
Assuming that Al Zahani buys the gambit and grants admittance to his compound, we'll need a unit to take up the guards on the outer perimeter. Once the guards are down and while we're inside, we'll need a unit to break into his weapons plant and secure the workers and whatever he's manufacturing. As to persuading Al Zahani to give up the information about the terrorist operation, I leave that entirely up to you and your interrogators. But Sophie, Jack, and I will need safe transportation out of Hebron.
Kayla nodded.
I said it's done, Liam. This is not our first go-around. We'll talk about it later.
Liam started to go back into the room, but Kayla grabbed his arm and pulled him back.
So, did you ask her?
I was just about to, but someone showed up at our dinner.
Sorry. Were you going to give her the ring?
Liam grimaced. I didn't get a chance to shop. Kayla shook her head.
Liam, you can't just ask her. You have to give her a ring. You have to do it right. She'll want to remember this for the rest of her life.
Liam sighed. I know, you're right. Kayla smiled and walked away.
See you tomorrow.
Chapter 67.
So that's where you left it? Catherine said.
You asked her about support and she said, we'll talk about it later?
I hope you said let me know how this all turns out.
Not exactly.
Well then, you can't go.
Liam smiled.
Thanks, Mom. I'm not kidding, Liam. It's one thing to ask you to poke around and ask questions, and yet another to ask you to pretend you'll pay the ransom money. But to ask you to jump into the middle of a military strike with inadequate backup or no backup? That's insanity.
Do you hear me arguing with you?
Good, then you're not going.
Liam scrunched his face.
Well, I didn't say I wouldn't go. Kayla's going to talk to Harry tomorrow, and she says we'll have all the support we need. I don't trust her, Liam. You heard Harry say she's obsessed with this doctor.
Liam nodded.
And you also heard him say he's never seen any proof that the man's a terrorist.
Liam nodded.
Stop nodding. I don't want you to go.
I get that. Catherine put her arms around him.
Please, don't do something foolish. Don't be so damn macho. Let the CIA handle their own problems.
I'm not being macho. I'm the one who made the contacts and set this whole thing up. I'm the one who's supposed to go with Summers to get his daughter. That's the plan we sold. How do I back out now? And what if Kayla's spot on? What about those 2,000 bags in Jerusalem? 2,000 screaming victims? She says the answers are all in the outbuilding. If we get the CIA support, get into the building and stop the attack, we'll save a lot of lives. Do you really want me to back out?
Yes, of course I do. I don't want you anywhere near this operation.
She hung her head.
But you're right. If you're able to help prevent an attack, and if the CIA protects you, then you should go.
He kissed her on the forehead and held her head on his chest. That's my baby. Catherine tossed and turned, waking Liam every few minutes.
Can't sleep? It's the time zone. I'm wide awake and it's only 3 a.m., and there's quite a bit on my mind. I think I need to go for a walk.
Liam rubbed his eyes.
All right, I'll go with you.
You don't have to.
It's okay.
Liam climbed out of the bed and put on his bathing suit.
Come on, we'll take a walk on the beach.
The grounds of the Mona Surf Rider were still and quiet. Oil torches lit the path to the beachfront, where the full moon laid an undulating path of yellow paint on the surface of the sea. Liam and Catherine walked barefoot onto the cool sand, and then ankle-deep into the surf. Hand in hand, they sloshed along, making their way south in the direction of Diamond Head. Catherine squeezed Liam's hand.
I know you wanted to talk to me at dinner. Is this a good time?
I do want to talk, but not right now. I'd like to wait a little bit. Catherine, an obvious look of disappointment on her face, stood still.
That's why I came out here.
Liam put his hands on her shoulders and looked into her eyes. I know, but it's just, I want it to be perfect, and I need to do something first. Look, can I promise you the tide will not go out without us? You can depend on it. I have my reasons. Let me do this my way, okay? She nodded and took his hand, and they continued their slosh through the surf. We do make a good couple, you know, Liam said. Catherine nodded.
I know.
They eventually came upon a secluded little alcove on the beach beneath a palm. Liam spread his t-shirt like a blanket, and there, on a warm Hawaiian night, they lay on the soft sand watching the moon make sparkles on the water. Kayla returned to the hotel the next morning. She found Catherine and Liam at the breakfast buffet.
I need to borrow your boyfriend for a few minutes, she said to Catherine.
There are lots of reasons that I should not like you, Catherine said, including the fact that you are sending him into a war zone.
Please take care of him. He's got this goofy macho mentality that makes him do things he shouldn't do.
I understand. He'll be well protected.
Did you talk to Harry? Liam asked Kayla as the two of them walked along the beach path behind the Mona Surf Rider.
We're all set.
That's a little too general for me. How are we all set?
We'll have proper support outside and in.
The CIA is going to fully support this operation? Kayla stopped and turned to face him.
Not the CIA. The support will come from in-country assets.
I'm not CIA, Liam. So, we finally decided to be honest. Who the fuck are you?
Nice talk. I'm Shabak, Israel Security Agency, Arab Affairs Department Counterterrorism. We'll get our support for this mission from the Israeli intelligence community. You can be assured of adequate manpower and material.
And Harry? Is he Shabak?
She shook her head. No, Harry is CIA, but in a liaison role.
They walked a bit farther in silence. Then Kayla said quietly,
I never meant to deceive you. You knew I wasn't just a resource analyst.
That's not the same as being honest. Liam's phone buzzed. He took it out of his pocket, read the text message, and showed it to Kayla.
Arif agrees to your terms. He will see you in 3 days at his home, April 12th at noon.
Good work, Liam. You got us in. We'll leave tomorrow. Mid-afternoon, and Kayla and Liam entered Summers' hospital room to find the bed empty. The station nurse informed them that he and his young lady were taking a walk. They found him sitting in a wheelchair in the hallway just around the corner. His IV was still in place, and attached to the hook on the wheelchair. Jack was out of breath.
We didn't get very far, Marcy said. Keep up the good work, Jack. You're looking very good, Kayla said chipperly.
You need to get your eyes checked, he said.
How much have you done?
He shook his head.
More than he should, answered Marcy. He had a hard time getting from the bed to the chair, and it's painful for him to sit. He had to have an injection of painkiller just to sit in the wheelchair. I'm pushing him because he doesn't have the strength in his arms to wheel himself. But he's got his mind set on going to Hebron. There's no talking him out of it.
I won't try, Kayla said. We want to leave tomorrow night.
Oh, come on, Kayla, what the hell? He's not well enough to travel and you know it, Marcy said. The doctor told us next week at the earliest. You're going to kill him.
I'm sorry, but next week is too late. The exchange is set for Friday. It's all been arranged. We have a flight out tomorrow night. Hold on, Kayla, Liam said. You can't kill the man. If he's not well enough, we'll have to go without him. As long as we're carrying the money, they won't care who's bringing it in. They think they're going to kill the messenger anyway.
That's encouraging, Jack said.
Don't you think there's some possibility that Arif will go through with the exchange? That he'll keep his word? That he'll give us Sophie and we can leave?
No, none at all, Kayla said. But if she's there, I intend to bring her back.
What do you mean, if she's there? Do you think he'd send her away or hide her?
In a heartbeat. But he's been told that it has to be a straight-up exchange. She'll need to be present for him to get the money.
Summers turned to Marcy.
I've got to go, Marcy. Sophie will need comforting, reassurance, and someone whose number one priority is her protection.
This whole business can fly out of control, can't it, Liam?
He nodded.
Yes, I'm afraid it can. For everyone involved.
Then we'll go tomorrow.
Chapter 68. Dimitri poured a generous portion of 25-year-old single malt into a crystal tumbler with a single block of ice and settled into a soft leather couch in his multimedia room to watch the Elite Eight quarterfinal basketball game with his 12-year-old son. Dimitri put his arm around his boy and anxiously awaited the tip-off on his 80-inch screen.
I think we're in for a hell of a game tonight, Zavit. Two teams ranked in the top five.
It's only a shame that St. Joe's didn't get this far, isn't it, Dad?
A shame indeed. But next year, Darius will return.
Dimitri's cell phone rang. He looked at the number and denied the call. It rang again. And again. Finally, he answered it.
Yes, Victor. How are you?
Shitty, why won't you take my calls?
Oh, have you been trying to reach me?
Don't fuck with me.
I've called 100 times.
You worry too much, my friend. I want to come see you. We need to talk.
No.
Not tonight. I'm watching a game with my son. We talk another time.
Dimitri, I'm already on my way. I'm in my car. You can break away from your game for a few minutes.
So then come.
15 minutes later, the doorbell rang and Dimitri's shapely young wife showed Kelson into the darkened multimedia room. Dimitri, in his white cable-knit sweater with the sleeves pushed up, motioned Kelson forward.
Come in.
Kelson walked slowly into the darkened room.
Victor, welcome. Have a seat. We talk at the halftime. Inessa, bring Mr. Kelson whatever he wants to drink.
Kelson sat in silence during the first half of the telecast. His breaths were short. He barely touched his glass of beer. Dimitri and David, on the other hand, were loud and animated in support of their team. Halftime finally arrived, and Dimitri said,
David, Mr. Kelson and I have a little business to discuss. Would you excuse us for a few minutes, please?
They know about our gambling, Kelson said when the boy had left the room.
You're upset because the woman lawyers knows we gamble? The NCAA tournament is the biggest gambling event of the year. Every business office has a bracket.
Kelson wagged his finger.
I'm not talking about a bracket, you asshole. She knows about you and me. And even Evgeny. And she brought up Darius McCord.
Dimitri turned around sharply, his gold chain necklace swinging to the side.
First of all, never call me an asshole. Are we understandable?
Kelson nodded. Sorry.
Second, I told you it was foolish to injure Darius.
Dimitri took a sip of his scotch.
I only wanted you to scare him. You were a madman.
But it was your guy, Evgeny, who broke his leg, and she knows about Evgeny. What's next, Dimitri? Does she ask me about the money? Does she want to know who sent Summers to Panama? I walked out before she could do that, you know.
She will know nothing unless you open your mouth. I have taken care, because I am a responsible man, of everyone who could put a finger on us. Evgeny is back in Moscow. Harrington, Ellis, and now Summers. All dead. Thank you very much.
Summers is dead?
Dimitri raised his eyebrows and nodded. He reached for his iPad, downloaded a page from the Honolulu Daily Paper, and handed it to Kelson.
Killed by a convict in jail?
Duh. My convict. Which is now costing thousands of dollars for lawyers. But Summers is dead, and no one is left who can testify against us. No one alive but you, Victor.
Ha! 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 Not funny, Dimitri.
Depends on the audience.
What do I do if she asks questions?
I thought you already gave your testimony.
I walked out. My lawyer was a stiff and I got scared. I'm gonna have to go back for another session.
Dimitri leaned toward Kelson.
Well, don't say anything. You don't know anything. You can't remember anything. Money was stolen from you, and no one can prove otherwise.
I don't know. She makes me real nervous. She knows stuff. It's like she can look through me.
Maybe you should take care of her.
You're a fool. Even if I did, someone else would pick up the case. I can't kill all the lawyers in this town. Maybe I should kill you.
I don't appreciate your Russian humor.
Stop your anxiety. I want to hear no more of this. Everything is buttoned up, nice and neat. Now go. The second half is starting.
Kelson stood. He shook Dimitri's hand.
Okay. Okay, good job with Summers, but I'm still worried. What if she asks me how I know Evgeny? It's not exactly a common name in Chicago. There ain't that many Russians around here. She'll connect you two together.
Kelson paused.
I know. Shut my mouth. I don't know nothing.
Right.
Kelson turned to leave.
I hope he didn't have Duke in this game. He'd have laid 8 points.
Goodbye, my friend.
When Kelson left, Dimitri punched in a number on his cell phone.
Evgeny, I need you to come back to Chicago. We have one more door to shut.
Chapter 69. Marcy pushed Jack's wheelchair up to a table outside Lappert's ice cream shop in the main concourse of Honolulu International, beside Kayla and Catherine. Liam approached carrying a tray with an assortment of ice cream cones, set them on the table, and distributed them.
I told you coconut macadamia nut fudge, Catherine said. What is this?
White chocolate macadamia nut.
How could you possibly confuse the two? They're nothing alike.
Well, excuse me, you could have done the shopping.
I wouldn't have made that mistake.
Here, take mine.
What is it?
Kauai pie.
Kauai pie? Seriously? What the hell is Kauai pie?
You're about to find out when you wipe it off your nose. Stop, Jack said. You're making my side hurt.
What time is your flight to Chicago?
Marcy said to Catherine.
5:30.
Catherine looked at Liam.
I wish you were coming home. I'm getting neurotic about this mission. He'll be fine, Kayla said. We'll take good care of him. I'm not sure I like the way you phrase that.
Kayla smiled.
There's a planning meeting in Tel Aviv tomorrow to lay out the details of the rescue. They know what they're doing. Jack, Marcy, Liam, and Sophie will all be home before you know it. You promised you'd talk to the prosecutor, Marcy said. Jack's risking his life. I talked to him this morning. They're reviewing it. There will definitely be an offer for his role in this operation. Unfortunately, I think a walk will be out of the question. Clemency, a possibility. Reduction in sentence, for sure. But a total drop of the charges, I don't think there's a chance. They're mindful of Jack's cooperation, but they're still the matter of the $88 million. Even though Jack may not have personally kept the money, he was an active conspirator in a major financial theft. The court will have to respect the victim and the financial injury done to his company. Jack will have to spend some time in custody. How many years? Well, that's up to the judge. Nevertheless, the prosecutors will meet with Jack and his attorney when he gets back to Chicago.
Whether I get clemency or not, Jack said, I have to go. We have no chance of getting Sophie if I don't show up. The disposition of my case is always secondary. Whatever happens to me, at least Sophie will be back in the U.S. and cared for by my family.
Jack might die, and you can't even promise him a deal.
Marcy's voice cracked.
I think we have to face facts, Jack said. I committed a serious crime. A prosecutor might recommend a lighter sentence, but I knew what I was doing. I helped a man steal a lot of money from Mr. Kelson, and I'm not going to return home a free man. I don't deserve to be a free man. That's why I keep telling you it's time to cut your losses.
Catherine stood.
My flight's boarding. I better go.
She threw her arms around Liam and held him like a vice.
Please come back to me, you crazy Irishman. We have to finish our talk.
I promise. Count on it.
Don't you let anything happen to him, Catherine said to Kayla.